people to buy my books. Every time I speak at a convention, the first words out of everybody's mouth is, are, did you bring any books to sell? And I said, no, I don't sell books at conventions. You can go online and buy Understanding Middle Earth by Michael Martinez. It has nothing to do with sanctifying misunderstandings. You can also buy Visualizing Middle Earth. You can buy them at Barnes & Noble, or you can buy it on Amazon, or probably anywhere else that somebody sells books online. You can also download Harmon and Dorian for free from freeebooks.net and several other places, some of them even authorized, including merp.com. You cannot, however, get a printed copy. This was a special print run edition. And if my life and schedule permit me to, when I get back to Seattle Sunday night, I'll write a review on the Tolkien Studies blog of Other Minds, which is a new Tolkien gaming journal coming out August 1st, I'm told. And technically, I have nothing to do with it, but it's free. It's a PDF file. You can download it.
As of August 1st.
As of August 1st. So I'm not allowed to tell you.
No, you are. You can talk about it whatever you want. It's fine.
Okay. It's
just MerpCon people get an extra release.
MerpCon people got an early preview.
Come next year.
Right. Is the camera on?
It is on.
Okay. So if you actually.
That webcam's on.
Okay. That webcam cannot see what I'm going to point at. I'm going to point at the maps on the wall behind me, which probably look like nothing more than white blotches on the internet. So these are new maps, and I'm probably going to write about these maps and express some Michael Martin's opinions about the implications of these maps and what I think people can accomplish with these maps. This is stuff that was first shown a week and a half ago at the German Tolkien Society by the map creator Thomas Morawiecki. It's late here in Spokane. Spokane?
Yes.
Okay. So, even though I haven't been here as much as everybody else, I'm tired of it. So, MerpCon 3 is launching a revolution in Tolkien gaming, and I think I can actually help participate in that revolution a little bit. I've been only moderately active in Tolkien gaming related activities. I've been contributing articles to the free downloadable newsletter, News for Free. I've written a couple of articles for them, and they write for them again. And the basic topic that I was writing about for News for Free was visualizing Middle Earth, the Third Age, about 1600, give or take. What we discussed was how someone like me, who likes to research Tolkien's descriptions of Middle Earth, could help expand gamers' view of Middle Earth in a more Tolkien-esque fashion. It's hard to say realistic since it's not really realistic. I'm a well-known critic of many traditional Tolkien points of view. Tolkien, you know, a lot of people like to say Tolkien was a medievalist. Tom Shippey, who knew Tolkien and who taught in the same position as Tolkien some years after Tolkien left that position, was once pressed by someone to say that Tolkien considered himself a medievalist. And Professor Shippey said, if you really pushed him, essentially put a gun to his head and forced him to say something, he would say, yes, I suppose I could be a medievalist. But Tolkien really called himself a classicist. And he thought of classicism somewhat differently than we do. I would say that Tolkien thought of everything before about 1500 AD as the classics, and everything since about 1500 AD as not classics. So Tolkien was raised on Greek mythology, Greek literature. He learned to read and speak Greek from his foster father, Father Francis Morgan. He also learned to read and speak Latin. And he read all of the Greek myths in the original Greek. He read the Bible in the not quite so original Greek in Latin. He discovered Germanic mythology and literature sometime around his 18th or 20th year. And of course, he never looked back, a lot of people think, but that's not entirely true. Tolkien blended a lot of different mythological elements and constructs in his writing, even going back all the way to the Book of Lost Tales. He was trying to create a Greek mythology for Old English. The Book of Lost Tales was supposed to be the lost Anglo-Saxon mythology, and even though he abandoned that project somewhere in the 1920s, he continued to develop a mythology that in many ways never fully abandoned its English roots. And as anyone who has read Tom Shippey's books would be wise to believe, The Lord of the Rings actually encapsulates a lot of English isms that are not necessarily obvious to people outside of England, but to someone who, particularly philologists, linguists who are very well versed in English literature and things like that. I'm talking about the Road to Middle Earth and J.R.R. Tolkien, author of the century. These are the two Tom Shippey books that people aren't most familiar with. Basically, The Lord of the Rings has a lot of inside jokes, but it also is very, Shippey makes an ironclad case that The Lord of the Rings is in English mythology, although it's not the mythology for England. And where I'm going with this is that Tolkien always had an ideal mythology he wanted to create, but he expressed it at different points in his life in different ways. So there are different mythologies there. And Middle-earth became a fusion of all these different mythologies. And I won't get into whether anybody is right or wrong to treat them as distinct mythologies or as separate phases of the same mythology. But my point is that it's a fusion. Middle-earth is a fusion of many influences, many mythologies, both Tolkien's own mythologies and other people's mythologies. And that brings us to gaming in Middle-earth. There is still gaming going on today. Some of the previous speakers have talked about the evolution of Middle-earth gaming, and they talk about Iron Crown Enterprises. Some of the speakers here, Chris Stephen Tom Alinsky, actually participated in Iron Crown projects and some of the cipher work that has been done. So there's a lot of experience here that Mercon created.
Joe Mandela.
Mandela. I actually recognize your last name. I'm just tired. So there's a lot of experience sitting right here in front of me. More experience than I've got in any one of them, in any one of their thumbnails, in terms of developing, editing, promoting, working with Tolkien-based games. So it's a fusion. The Middle-earth gaming environment is a fusion of ideas. It's a fusion of mythologies. It's a fusion of influences and interests. And I was having a conversation with several of the folks earlier today, and I remember the first time Christina tried to get me involved in the Tolkien gaming community, invited me to join a mailing list where an ongoing discussion was get really heated about Tharbad, which is the city on the river Eriador. The gamers were trying to figure out what Tharbad should look like, what sort of city it should be. And instead of really looking at how Tolkien described the cultures that came together beneath of Tharbad in that area, they were talking in terms of gaming and stuff. And they had all these thieves guilds, magic users, stuff that Tolkien probably wouldn't have any idea of what to do with. And I was kind of in shock when I said to Chris, I don't know what you were hoping I would do. You know, it's clearly that, but look what they did to poor Tharbad. Which I think that the gamers need something to do with Middle-earth that looks and feels like a game, but they also want Middle-earth to look and feel like Tolkien's Middle-earth as much as possible. And not everybody is as trained in Tolkien's background as Tolkien was. So it's not fair to expect everybody to see Middle-earth the way he did. So I was listening to some of the things that people are doing, and I was also thinking about what I've been doing for the News from Bree newsletter, which is published by Middle-earth Games over in the UK. They do the play-by-email games. And it occurred to me that one thing that people could do with any level of experience, any level of knowledge, is think about what kind of games that the races of Middle-earth would play. Would elves who live for thousands of years play the same kinds of games as, say, hobbits who are very rustic and colloquial, or as Numenoreans who can be very sophisticated and civilized? What sort of games would the Dunedain's play? What sort of games would the dwarves play? And there are references to games in Tolkien's literature. Of course, everybody knows about Bilbo's riddle game with Gollum. Riddle games go all the way back to classic Mediterranean literature. If anybody's familiar with the story of Oedipus and the Sphinx, he had to solve the Sphinx's riddle. But that's not the only riddle game that comes out of ancient literature. The riddles that Tolkien used, of course, I think everybody is familiar with, are based on popular, or what I guess what Tolkien decided were popular, medieval English riddles. So a lot of people would say, well, he would use medieval English riddles. I don't think he would necessarily do that. He would do that for a certain time, a certain culture, a certain group of people. But he wanted Middle-earth to look different at different points in time. When some of the artists at Weta needed some research for the Peter Jackson movies, I was one of the people that they contacted, and they asked me some questions about things. One of the discussions that we had over the period of 6 months where I was doing this research for them was, how should Middle-earth look in the Second Age versus the Third Age? And although they actually didn't go in the direction that I hoped they would go, I think they did a great job with what they did do, because basically they took the elves and the Numenoreans of the Second Age, and they made them look like a high civilization, whereas the end of Middle-earth looked very medieval. So I could get caught up in the fact that it did look medieval, but that's not really the point. The point is that they show the decline in the sophistication of the cultures of Middle-earth, which is what Tolkien really was trying to do in The Lord of the Rings. He was trying to show that Middle-earth at that point was in a state of decline, and people were looking back to a time when there was more knowledge, more technology, more everything, including more people. That's not just something that relates to medieval Europe, that also relates to ancient Greece, which went into a sort of dark ages of medieval period from about 1200 BCE to about 800 BCE. And around 800 BCE, as many people know, a poet named Homer wrote a couple of long poems. One was called the Iliad. Homer was one of a group of poets who lived over a period of about 200 years. They were called the epic poets. And they wrote an entire cycle of poems, each one addressing a different part, that told the story of the war between the Greeks and the Trojans. But the entire war was documented through this poetry. Does that sound like something Tolkien might have done in some of his writing? Well, it sounds like the Silmarillion, which documents this entire world war between Noldor and Morgoth through different stories from different sources. So Tolkien was looking back to a very classical idea of a fusion of different resources, of different influences and ideas. And I think that gaming can do that too. I think that if you've got a game group where you have a traditional game rep and player group, the players can still enhance the game by thinking about the kinds of things that the cultures that they represent with their characters might do in Hoping's perspective. Hoping's perspective is not, well, let me take something from ancient Greece and put it here. Let me take something from medieval England and put it here. It's how did I get this culture to this point? Of course, he started with language. You don't have to be a linguist to understand that part. But every word in the Tolkien language has a story behind it. So some of the words, some of the names might be associated with games. I remember going to a Renaissance festival some years ago where a friend and I came upon the Mud Games. Now, I have no idea whether these guys were even close to representing anything that actually happened in the Middle Ages, but their show was basically built around the yelling contest. They said that in the Middle Ages, towns that they couldn't afford to bring in entertainers or anything like that, so one village would gather on one side of the river, another village would gather on the other side of the river, and then shout, and they hire somebody to judge which group could yell better. So, is that true or not? I have no idea. But that's the kind of thing that you could say somebody in Middle Earth might do something like that if they don't have it. And there are times and periods in Middle Earth where the economy has been crushed. Bree, when Frodo comes through, is no longer thriving. The reason why it's no longer thriving is that there's nobody left. Shire and Bree no longer communicate with each other. The Numenoreans have dwindled. Tharbad was their last city, and it had been deserted for about 80 or 90 years, maybe actually 100 years, I think. The elves had just gone through their last major migration, a handful lingering, waiting to find out if they were going to be fleeing Sauron's armies or celebrating his defeat with one last voyage over sea. But basically, there's nobody left in northern Middle Earth to keep the Bree economy really going strong. So, what would the people of Bree be able to do for entertainment? They'd all go hang around the Grand Company and talk about the good old times. So maybe they would have come up with some other things to do. Rangers. What do Ranger children do? The kids growing up in the angle of their Imlad dress, they're not old enough to be Rangers. They can't go out and fight orcs, dwarves, trolls, and things like that. But what do boys naturally do? They play war games. They pretend to hunt. And eventually they practice these skills and they go on to perfect them, to become real hunters, to become real soldiers, rangers, and things like that. So maybe rangers have ranger games. And in a Tolkien game, you might want to think about how ranger characters would pass the time away, where they could hone their skills and compete with each other a little bit, because that's really what a lot of games are about, is competition. Mono a mono, proving who's the best. So basically, games are a way that we teach ourselves, our children, a little bit more about our culture, about our history, the skills that we want them to learn, and help them become better at what they do. So, listening to everybody here at Mercon, I actually came totally unprepared to talk. I put together these ideas about how games could incorporate games within them. This sort of a Frank Herbert, you know, wheels with wheels kind of thing. But I think that that's one way that Tolkien gaming can evolve a little bit, where people can start thinking about, you know, how would these characters learn their skills? How would they enhance their skills? How, if you're going to put together a Tolkien game, why would your bad guys, say, pursue a certain kind of strategy? I actually wrote about Stalin's strategies, some essays that were published in Understanding the Word. And he always had some sort of a plan. Second Age, when he came back, he was still subservient to Morgoth. And I was thinking today or earlier, would he have used the name Gothmog? He devised the Black Tongue in the Second Age. And Tolkien said in one of his letters that Sauron continued to be loyal to Morgoth during the Second Age. But at the end of, in the Third Age, he claimed to be Morgoth returned. And as we know in the Lord of the Rings, the lieutenant, Minas Morgul, was called Gothmog. Now, some people have speculated that Dock Park might actually be the town of Sour Rock. I think part of the argument is that there's a scene where Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are looking at a bunch of dead orcs, and they see some of the Esrim on their helmet, so we find out that those are Uruk-hai, and the S stands for Sauron. But I think Gimli says S is for Sauron, and Aragorn says, well, he doesn't forget his true name to be spoken. And a lot of people puzzled over that for quite a few years. And I think that the argument that Gondor may be the mouth of Sauron makes sense. Mog, I think, goes all the way back to Kenya or something like that in the Book of Lost Tales. It's a speculative translation that might mean voice of Morgoth, God being Morgoth. So it's kind of interesting. It's all speculative. You can't really prove it conclusively. But if Sauron really claimed to be serving Morgoth in the Second Age, maybe he called himself Godhog so that people wouldn't really know that he was Sauron. I'm not sure why that would have been important to him, but subterfuge seems to always be a part of his strategies in the Second Age and Third Age. He never really reveals who he truly is. So that's just one aspect of enhancing Tolkien games. Is, I think if you think about why somebody would do something, then you can break that down into a more simplistic set of rules and say, okay, we can create a game here. There's actually a passage in the Lord of the Rings, so I don't have it in memory, but I think somebody says, we're just pawns, or they're just pawns, or something like that. And through the years, a lot of people have said, well, they must play chess in Middle-earth, because Tolkien, you know, uses this pawn passage. And some people have tried to rationalize that by saying, well, you know, it's just the translation thing. It's a Tolkien pretends to be a translator who's working with an ancient book written in another language and doesn't have an exact equivalent, so he substitutes a chess term, which would be similar for the express train reference at Bilbo's farewell party, where the firework dragon swoops down over the hobbits, and the narrative says that it makes a sound like an express train. So a lot of people say, well, does that mean that they're express trains in Middle-earth? No, it doesn't mean that. It should be assumed, I think, that the narrator of the story is giving the modern reader a comparative voice to describe what the firework might have sounded like in that imaginary time in our past. So Tolkien did put in references to games here and there that he didn't really extrapolate or expand upon, and I don't see any reason why people can't think of those terms. Because very simplistic war games would be what the nobles of Gondor and Arnor use to teach their sons to become war leaders. Orcs probably had brutal games of skill. If you go back to the Iliad, we were also talking about this earlier today too. On the indoor mailing list, I sporadically this summer have been talking about the Iliad and connections or possible connections between the Iliad and Middle-earth. And one of the things that they do in the Iliad is they have games to celebrate things or to mourn people, the passing heroes, and things like that. So it's reasonable to ask, would the game, the elves or the Numenoreans have some sort of games? And somebody said, well, you know, in Unfinished Tales, Tolkien wrote that Galadriel was very skilled in athletic games and things like that. That's probably an example of where Tolkien was trying to work some of that Greek mythology or tradition into Middle-earth, although that was a very late development. I think that came out in the last year of his life, if I recall correctly. So he was always going back to his roots and looking at things, but there are suggestions or opportunities where Tolkien leaves openings for people to insert gaming or games, things like that. I think that the elves, in addition to games of physical capability, physical prowess, they probably would have had games of mental prowess. Imagine the Land of Dolmore, the Master, War Masters, and Tops, training their children, if not their apprentices, in linguistic skills with word games. We actually do have word games. When I was in college, I did some tutoring, and I tutored a 12-year-old girl whose English class was required to put together a game based on the 8 parts of speech. And we put together a little monopoly-like game where you had to build a sentence by moving a piece around the board. So we actually do that. We make games based on words. When I was in elementary school, I remember our teacher would put Merry Christmas on the board and ask us how many words we could get out of that expression.
We're doing that.
Yeah. Hangman is a word game. A lot of people play Hangman where you have to spell a word and if you miss it, then the guy gets closer to the gallows. Scrabble is a word game. So our society, our culture, is very well endowed with word games. And I think that Tolkien's elves especially would probably love word games. The Noldor, in particular, would have wanted to invest a lot of time in word games because they were running around the map learning everybody else's languages. So those are my thoughts. That's what I've got down for Vermont. That's what I've got out of the fact that people are doing something special here. Other Minds, let me talk about this a little bit. Other Minds is inspired by Chris Stevens' old journal, Other Hands. But it's a new attempt to bring together the Tolkien gaming community to provide some original thought and research, not only on how games can go or what we can do with Tolkien gaming, but to get people to think in a new way about Middle-earth, because the idea behind the title, Other Minds, as it was behind Other Hands, was that Tolkien always saw that he would never completely finish it. And he felt, he even said in one of his letters, that at some point, Other Hands would have to pick up what he was doing and carry on. He was thinking probably in terms of artistic expression. There's a lot of art, the way that Tolkien envisioned art, because to Other Hands, Other Minds, the kind of things that these journals deal with. So this is an opportunity now for Tolkien specialists, researchers, gamers around the world to put pen to paper and start thinking about things. Other Minds will be taking submissions. The first issue will go online August 1st. Like I said, I'll try to review it on the Tolkien Studies on the web blog, and I'll have a lot of good things to say about it. I read the articles this weekend, and I just think they're, you guys have really done a great job here putting this together. And I know that some material did not make it in, so the next issue, yeah, it's going to be a quarterly journal. I think it should be treated with very great respect. I think that a lot of people should look for it. So that's basically all I've got to say at this point. Anybody have any questions or anything? We got a microphone, folks, so those of you watching or watching.
Okay. What do you think Tolkien's reaction to Middle-earth role-playing would be?
Well, I don't think the concept would have been all that foreign to him, actually. As I understand it, role-playing games have been around for a long time. And there were some parlor games that he probably was familiar with that would have been very similar to role-playing games. He probably did a lot of role-playing in his own life as a writer, but also as a researcher. Think about it. If you're going to present a fugitive mythology, the whole thing about the mythology for England was that the invasion of 1066 wiped out the Anglo-Saxon traditions. The literature was gone. The memory of folklore and things like that was gone. It just lingered on in words and expressions in the English language that nobody really understood anymore. So he was trying to reconstruct a plausible Anglo-Saxon pathology based on traces of language. He had to role play that. He had to work through the ramifications because he wasn't just letting his mind wander and tell a story. He was trying to tell a story that worked out according to specific rules that he could see. So, I don't know if he would have approved of mental work gaming, but I think he would have understood it. And I think at some level, he probably would have accepted that people would want to do this without necessarily approving it. I don't want to speak for him. Is that...
That's reasonable.
Okay, thank you. Chris, you had a question. We're going to pass the microphone to the far side.
This is, again, more of a comment. I like what you suggested about thinking on what games peoples in Middle Earth would use to socialize and acculturate their children. I talked much earlier today, about doing online gaming and how that allows one to sort of slow the pace down and really explore characters from the inside out. I had actually tried this once with an elven character, where I was running a game for an elven character. My goal was to explore what that character's upbringing would be like and what sort of things that character's parents, siblings, community members would teach that character in order to become a member of that society. And I didn't get quite as far as the games, but I thought in terms of that one of the functions that games can serve in a role-playing setting is it can help the player get inside not just the mind of the character, but the whole, especially if it's non-human character, what does it mean to relate to the world as a deathless being? Games can give hints to that, and the language then, of course. So I think that's an excellent idea, and I hope other people will pursue that.
I hope so too. I think Tolkien was exploring some of that direction. If you take a look at the Athelred with Finrod and Andred, there was a dialogue in the old Greek fashion. It was a debate between two characters. A lot of the Greek philosophers like to present their ideas through these dialogues, but you can turn that into a debating game. It's very, very close, very similar to that. I did actually, many years ago, rep a game, Rolemaster, where I put a game in. The game had been an ongoing game. I think that game was played for about 17 years by various people. And I was the third or fourth person to actually get to referee that game. So by the time I inherited it, the game world was so robust, so full of detail and richness that I had to come up with something unique. So I came up with a game I called Two Flags. And it was sort of based loosely on basketball, what we call soccer, and medieval style melee, certain recreational societies like to engage in. And if I recall correctly, each side had a flag, each team had a fixed number of people, and some of those people were offensive, some of them were defensive. So the offensive guys had to work their way through some sort of a maze, and defensive guys had to defend their flag, and whoever captured the other team's flag got back to their side first and won the game. So I do actually have some experience at bringing some game stuff into a game. I just thought of that. And to be honest, I think that one was not very popular with the players. I'm not sure why. So, but I would still like to see people trying to do that.
Okay, I know you like to talk a lot, so just a general question. Where do you think Middle Earth is going to be going from now? Because I know Tolkien obviously not going to produce anything else that limits that as to this.
Try it. I'm going to repeat that.
Okay, I know, like, with Tolkien not actually being able to produce anything else,
Where exactly do you think Middle Earth is going to go from here on? Is it just gaming, or are they going to try to expand it beyond that?
As I understand it, Carl Hostetter's group still has a fair amount of linguistic material to publish. And although I haven't yet looked at the last issue that they put out, almost every issue that they have published where they've brought forth new linguistic material, they've published in historical material and in cultural revelations and things like that. So assuming that they keep going that direction, they will probably continue to expand the core elements of the Middle-earth legendary. Let's just call it that. The legendary is all encompassing, and we don't have to haggle over whether it's one or many mythologies. But I think that there's still a lot going on there. Also, people are probably going to be very interested in the history of the Hobbit. And the academic community, probably inspired by Michael Drout, has picked up the pace with their critical research. They're not really interested in so much in the destruction of the world as they are in explaining the esoteric themes of Middle-earth, but they're probably going to evolve into a new phase of what we can call metacriticism. I think that we're already on the verge of metacriticism, where we're going to see perennially complex volumes of critical essays that actually try and explore a specific theme, things like that. People have tried it in the past. It hasn't been very successful, but I suspect that it's going to happen in the next 10 years or so. Any other questions?
You discussed a little bit some cultural analogs to the classical Greek world. I'd be interested in hearing some of your opinions on what further on what some of those analogs might be, for instance, maybe to the Minoans or Mycenaeans in more detail.
What comparisons can I draw between Tolkien's world and classical Greek cultures? The Numenoreans owe a lot to the Spartans and to the Athenians. They owe a lot to the Spartans in their warlike phase. They owe a lot to the Athenians in their mariner explorations, their mariner activities. Of course, Tolkien said that they owe a lot to the Egyptians, in terms of their architecture and their fascination with death. The Mycenaeans are interesting. They had those bull jumping frescoes. People think they must have had some sort of rituals or games where very stupid, the brave young lads leaped over bulls. I think there are a small number of people now who can actually do that. I've seen somebody do it on videotape. I don't know if it was fake or what. But, quite possibly, I'm thinking of the Palace of Ephesus, where it was very beautiful, very ornate. I think that some of the later, the decadent phase, Numenor, may have been influenced in part by the decadence of Knossos. Hard to say. One of the Numenorean kings was fascinated with Mithril, and he sought it out, collected Mithril, and I think he had a nickname that had something to do with silver or something like that. That reminded me of King Aenus. Chris is saying something. That
it was a Talamite, the silver king.
Right. So that story reminded me of King Aenus, minus Aenus, with the golden touch. I don't think that there are that many very strong elements. I think that Tolkien just like took something here, took something there. He called the Rohirrim Homeric horsemen. And if you read the Iliad, you'll see plenty of references to horse tamers and horse raisers, horse this and horse that. But these guys were just using horses to pull chariots. Where they seem to resemble the Rohirrim, though, is their openness, their trustworthiness, their talk, there's like one scene in particular where two characters, Iliad, one's a Trojan, one's a Achaean, they meet in the midst of the battle, and they realize that they have a connection through family. I think they're both related to somebody they were great friends. And these two guys take a vow not to fight each other. They exchange each other's armor, and they go back to their own side, resume killing everyone but each other. And that's basically what Éomer does with Aragorn. You know, Éomer has just slaughtered 200 orcs. He's violated Rohirric law to do that, but Rohan is basically at war, and he has to arrest any strangers that he finds that he doesn't kill. So Aragorn pops up out of the grass and introduces himself, basically claims to be the rightful king of Gondor, and Éomer says, well, you know what, I'm going to give you 3 horses and I'll trust you to bring them back. And I think that's right out of the Iliad. I mean, that is literally right out of the Iliad, because the two guys in a war situation instantly become friends. And there is a family connection there. Aragorn says to Éomer, you know, I knew your father, and I think he was a man of honor, and I think that you're the same kind of man. So it's these very subtle, minor, one-off points that I see where Tolkien seems to borrow a lot of Greek literature. But Greek literature also influenced medieval literature, because there are a number of medieval poems that actually rewrite some of the ancient Greek poems.
On the Egyptian connection, this is something that's always fascinated me, because Tolkien mentions it only once. Obviously, in his letter, he has the visual representation of the crown of Numenor as resembling the Egyptian pharaoh's crown. But I wonder, when people try to take that and the few other elements that he mentions and sort of study Egyptian culture and hope to find the key to Numenorean culture, my inclination is to think more that I would want to look into Edwardian and Victorian images of Egypt as behind Tolkien saying they were like the Egyptians. You know, were the Egyptians really obsessed with death, or is this a Victorian view of the Egyptians? And if it is, how is that view represented in Tolkien's own culture? And to find artistic representations of Egyptians in the turn of the century, that might be just as fruitful way of thinking about how he might have imagined the Numenoreans as any particular Egyptian artifact or something.
Yeah, I don't think he was interested in the artifacts that much. I mean, the crown and the diadem were artifacts. I think he was more interested in Egyptian grandeur and Egyptian decadence. And the sense that, you know, Egypt accomplished a lot. It was an ancient culture. It arose thousands of years ago. And in one way or another, persisted until the Romans came along and just absorbed it into their empire. So Egypt is an unusual stroke of longevity in Western history. And I think Tolkien was very inspired by that. I don't think that he meant for Numenorean culture to look a lot like Egyptian culture at all, but he certainly did draw some comparisons on the basis of architecture. And one or two cultural points. And again, it goes back to that fusion thing. I think he was just trying to forge different elements into something new.
You could also say that, or think of it in terms of the image of Egypt as a great civilization that's accomplished much, and in some sense, that's a Greek view of Egypt. And that you find that in Greek literature about Egypt, and maybe, again, your Tolkien classes is coming in again.
Herodotus actually wrote about Egypt. He had some interesting stories to tell about Egypt. And the Atlantis story, which came from Plato attributed to Egyptian priests. So there are certainly a lot going on between Greek literature and Egypt. And I'm sure Tolkien was very much aware of that. Any other questions or comments? Or anybody online asking me?
Oh, no.
No.
Actually,
see, what happened was there were about a dozen people waiting in the chat room exactly at midnight, and at about 5 after, they kept saying, were we wrong? Is Martinez not going to be on the air? We didn't get on the air until about a quarter after.
Oh,
sorry, about a dozen people failed in different chat rooms. So the good thing is a lot of people really were excited.
Well, I did apologize to the to the folks that were in the chat room. I guess I could share a couple of questions that I've received privately. About once a month, somebody asked me if I'm going to write another book about Tolkien. I'm not ready to write another book about Tolkien. It takes a lot of time, a lot of research. And because I've been moving around for the past couple of years, in 2004, I took all my books to Florida. I left them in storage there with my family. And only in the past few weeks have I actually gotten all those books back. So my Tolkien research is way out of date. But I'm also heavily invested in some other activities right now. I do a lot of research in search engine optimization. And I actually write for the company I work for, I write a blog about SEO theory. That takes up a lot of my time. I did, some people have also asked me if I'm just going to write about Tolkien on a more regular basis. And I went on the Tolkien Studies on the web blog last week, and I said I might try and write some weekly essays there, just this blog post. I do have, I don't know if I want to call it a commitment, but the firm is right now the only designated authoritative resource for new Tolkien essays that I produce, except for special arrangements like this I made with Things for Free. But up until now, anytime I wrote a new Tolkien essay, I would post it on MERP and MERP.com. I still intend to occasionally contribute essays to MERP.com, but a lot of thought and research goes into those essays. I feel a little more freedom on the blog. I don't feel like I have to really put as much into it, and I don't want people to take that the wrong way. It's just that I don't have that much time for it.
Weird.
And also the Iliad discussion continues on the indoor mailing list. I'll try to get it done, I think by the end of September, maybe October. When I did the Beowulf discussion last year, it took 10 months. I will try not to drag it out that much. Somebody asked me about 2 months ago what I thought I might do after the Iliad. I can't think that far down the line. But there are some other poems that I think Tolkien probably looked at, not necessarily classical poems. But I think there are some other stories here that people would be interested in. One is called The Call of Troy, and it's not actually a Greek poem, it's a Latin poem. I think it dates from about the first century. Christian shaking his head. I've written about that poem, but it's been a while since I looked at it. It's fairly long, and I think it had a considerable influence on some of Tolkien's characters and things like that. And I might consider doing some commentary on that poem maybe next year.
How about, you were here earlier for Thomas Lewinsky's discussion about the new Ardo maps. Did you have any commentary you want to make on that? Or?
I think these maps are going to set a new standard. I really do. I don't think that we can foresee everything. As you guys have already told me, these maps have been challenged. I think there will be other challenges to them. But for too long now, not to take anything away from Karen Fonstad, because she put a lot of work and a lot of love into her maps. But she's been the authority. Barbara Streit has never quite accomplished that. I don't think the Brian Sibley stuff either. Everybody pretty much looks at Karen Fonstad's book as the standard. And I think that since these maps are going to become available for anybody to work with, that you've set the new standard. People are going to compare all future map making about Middle-earth to these maps. And even if they propose alternative interpretations, I think those interpretations will be compared to this work more than to Fonstad's. And I certainly hope that turns out to be the case, because a lot of time and a lot of love for Tolkien and these maps. And I think people will just be blown away when they start to download them. With, can I say that?
Yeah.
Other minds, yes. When you get the PDF for other minds, you will get to see the maps. And I think everybody will really like it.
Anybody have any other questions?
I'm assuming this is the case, but are you going to be reviewing future articles that are going to keep coming up for the future Other Minds magazines?
I'm officially designated as a reviewer.
Super critic.
I talked to exactly Hawk and Tom Thomas. They basically put the issue together. I think there were several people.
Oh yeah. No, it's, I mean, there's a dozen people that helped with ideas, feedback, submissions. There's more than a dozen, or yeah, a little over a dozen on the staff list that worked together on it. So Thomas did the lion's share of layout, putting together and making that book as great as it does. I provide a lot of technology to enable a lot of that. We threw up there a whole bunch of different ideas, but it is a group effort. A lot of people are making that happen, and the nice thing is when we got the PDF to the staff list, of course, anybody who's on the staff list or is a contributor, they get to see it before anybody else does. And the nice thing is get people excited. Now, the next issue is not coming out until January, just because we haven't quite gotten our whole process going and we're waiting for more content. But we do plan to go quarterly as soon as we can.
I won't have the ability, I won't be in any position to say yay or nay. Give feedback, because the
other that's all it is.
Yeah, the editors will make the choices on
right.
What goes into the...
You give commentary that people appreciate your viewpoint.
Yeah, so I mean, I hope to be able to see, to participate in the process as a reviewer, and eventually also to contribute. But I don't want anybody's watching this and they were thinking, oh wow, I'd like to submit, oh my god, Martinez is going to see it.
No,
that's not, Martinez doesn't have the power
right.
to say, this is good or this is bad, I'll just give feedback. And the editors will take that into consideration. And
it is pretty much down to Thomas and I who decide what goes in the magazine. But that's with a lot of discussion if there's anything that isn't real obvious from the whole staff.
Right. It just says Other Minds, not Martinez.
Yeah.
But the magazine behind it is still close enough to Other Minds to have an influence over it. And I recommend anybody to read his free PDF download the
Carmen Doran?
Yes.
Oh, you meant Carmen Doran.
Oh, yeah.
I actually not finished reading it, but I'm about halfway through, got distracted. But that's actually an excellent gaming resource.
It's like very good.
I really enjoyed what I've read so far, and for any new players to Middle Earth, I would most definitely recommend them reading that again, just to get an understanding of Middle Earth and the races without having to read books and books and books. It's just very well put together material for a gamer to get introduced to Middle Earth, in my opinion.
Thank you. It was reviewed by 10,000 people before it reached. I'm not joking. The original version of Carmen Doria was just essays I put up on a website, one of my first websites. And I kept receiving emails from teachers and librarians, students, with comments, feedback, and requests for permission, things like that. So it has actually been looked at by a lot of people. And that's the third edition.
On RIP.com alone, it's definitely over 10,000 downloads.
We stopped tracking people downloads several years ago. The last number I had was over a million downloads. There are not many ebooks that I knew of that have had over a million downloads.
Do you want to give, just for some of those who aren't familiar, just a quick rundown of what it's about, what it contains?
Well, I can read the table of contents.
Sure.
First of all, I'd like to point out that the artwork, the cover art, was done by, I believe she's a German artist, Akia.
Yes.
She's extremely, extremely good, and she's probably much improved since she did this artwork. We did invite several other people to contribute to Harman and Dorian, but they never, we never got that very far. There was only one of the first who actually contributed, and can't find it. His name is Rich Sullivan. He did the orc head, which I thought was just absolutely fantastic. The only thing is, his orc was green, and he asked me if I would keep it green. I sort of didn't answer his reply, his question. Green orcs and ham don't really go very well. So the book is broken down into the geography of Arda. A lot of people do cover the geography of Arda. It's nothing too spectacular. Then I go into a brief history of Arda. Then I talk about the elven peoples of Arda, the Avari, the Sylvan Elves, the Sindar, the Noldor, the Valmari, and the Vanyar, and that's really not all of them. Then I go into the men of Arda, and I talk about the Adani peoples. And then chapter 5 is orcs and other fell things. And it goes into what the orcs look like. There's actually an appendix with more information on orcs that came out. I forget why we didn't incorporate that appendix into the main chapter. It's been several years. Chapter 6 is a little bit of hobbit lore. It talks about where hobbits came from, what happened to Smeagol's people, and how did hobbits go to sea. There's speculative comments in some of these essays. Some people criticize me by saying, you know, I'm trying to pass off my speculations as fact or something like that. I don't think I need that. It's obvious. It's pretty obvious that I'm being speculative on some of these things. Chapter 7 is things you might not have known about the Northmen. Back when I wrote that, it was probably true. I think a lot of this material has been covered pretty well since then by various sources. Then I got into a whimsical essay, What Does an Elf Do in a Hon? I mean, you get across the sea, you've got eternity to spend there, what are you going to do? I think that they have to do something. And probably consistent with more than just playing games. What does a woodman do all day? You read about the woodman and the hobbit. What do? Do they just go out and chop the wood? Do they turn more wood? How much wood would a woodman chop if a woodman could chop wood? Manning the Middle Earth Wedding. Many years ago, a lot of people got on the internet. They were looking for information on how to design a wedding after Tolkien's wedding that he mentioned in his stories. I don't know if there's actually that much information in here, but I did give it my best shot, and I was actually told that a number of weddings were organized, taking the information that I collected into consideration. And there's a chapter called The Wonders of Middle-earth. I broke it up into the Wonders of the First Age, Wonders of the Second Age, and Wonders of the Third Age. Finally, chapter 12 is probably the most heavily used chapter. It's a chronology for Tolkien's four ages. This is actually an abbreviated chronology based on a much longer chronology that was done by an old website that's no longer available. It was called Parma Ambernatse, and I'm probably butchering the Elvish. I apologize for that. If I recall correctly, the title translated into the web book, and the editor of that project invited me and several other very knowledgeable people to contribute information for a timeline and some other resources that covered a lot of stuff. I wish that website was still around. I know that you might be able to dig for it on archive.org, but it's very difficult to find. Okay, Hawk is telling me I've got to wrap it up, so thank you all very much.
Thank you so much for coming back to the show.